I'll start the talk with a little story. About a year ago, I was at a conference in Vancouver, and during the conference, so there in Vancouver, the D-Way people invited us and some other people doing quantum information to come visit their factory, their research area. And you know, of course, I was very interested in what we're doing. Now, I have this really kind of weird thinking about D-Wave. Sometimes I think they're absolutely crazy, and sometimes I'm absolutely jealous of them, because they have this very unusual idea that you can build a quantum computer without quantum coherence, or maybe with minimal quantum coherence. Okay, and that's kind of their corporate strategy. They have some idea that they can do that, and if you do that, it's not so hard to build a quantum computer. You can do that with technology that's kind of in hand. Of course, if that idea doesn't work, well, then you've spent a lot of time building something, you know, that may be not interesting. Anyway, I went there. I was really impressed with the technology and the hardware. They're making essentially almost classical Josephson junction circuits. That's really state-of-the-art. Measurements, really good. They started talking about recent experiments where they found the ground state of 100 qubits. Of course, with 100 qubits, you have 2 to the 100 states that you could fall into. And the fact that they were claiming to get to some ground state, kind of interesting. So at that point, I decided, look, it's really time for the scientists, kind of we were distancing ourselves from them, it's really time to figure out what the heck is going on inside, you know, the D-Wave black box. We have to pull away the curtain a little bit to understand that. So coming back, because we were working with Microsoft, I met Matthias Troyer, who had wanted to do the same thing, and we got together and decided, okay, let's try to figure out what's going on inside this D-Wave quantum annealer, figure out what's going on. Now, in this work, this has mostly been done by Matthias and his team of people. This is his talk that he gave earlier. He's just let me borrow the slides. I'd like to just share what we've learned. There's a paper coming out soon that, you know, will explain all the details. But I think I can give you just the basic ideas. We really understand now, we think, what's going on in this machine. And it's really kind of interesting. The jury's not still out on what if it's going to be useful, but it's really kind of interesting to figure out what's going on. So, okay, here's the D-Wave machine. There's the standard, you know, blurb from their marketing department. Yes, you can buy for about $10 million this quantum machine annealer. The one we're going to talk about was about 128 machine, and now they've delivering 500 qubit machines, okay? And the start of the project, and what we really wanted to know is, you know, what's inside this black box? Okay, of course we know something about the superconducting circuits, but instead of like arguing and writing on blogs and people just talking about what's going on and what it's doing and having to read, you know, marketing literature, let's do the scientific method to actually figure out what's going on. And this is kind of an interesting scientific, it's kind of a sociological issue. You see, D-Wave one, they really don't care exactly how this thing works, as long as it gives good answers, as long as it beats other things. So, you know, whatever their ideas are, in the end, they're kind of like engineers. They just want to know it's working. And I would say if you're a company, you're trying to sell your company and get investment capital, whatever, it's maybe good not to know too much what's going on there, because you might have to disclose that, and that might scare people off, okay? So they're really interested in making a useful machine, which is a cool, interesting thing. But I think what happened here is we really came, some scientists came and said, let's do experiments on this. Let's use the scientific method to figure out what's going on here. Instead of writing about it, let's do a real science experiment. And what's really great, if you do a science experiment on this, you can kind of figure out what's going on. And that's what this talk is about. It's really kind of neat that you can stop arguing about whether what's going on here, and you can know to some degree. Okay, so the machine is not a universal quantum computer. It's not perfectly coherent. In fact, like you said, their strategy is to take, you know, imperfect qubits and make something out of it. And it's not an adiabatic quantum computer. It works at finite temperatures, at finite sweep rates, and the like. But D-Wave claims it's a programmable IC model in a transverse field, okay, and solves problems with quantum annealer. And, okay, you know, here's the marketing jargon. But, okay, you know, that's what they're claiming. And we want to understand, is this really true? Is it actually going to be useful for something? So what are the open questions?
So inside the box, is it still the flux qubit geometry?
Yeah, it's flux qubits. I'll talk about that. It's flux qubits, and I'll talk about the geometry a little bit. We know how it's built, you know, that basic idea how it's worked. But, you know, we're not going to concentrate too much on the hardware and the coherence, or you get entanglement. Those questions lead you down an infinite morass, blind alley, doesn't do what you want to do. What you want to know, does it really implement this programmable icing model in a transverse field? Does the machine really work like a quantum annealer? And is there any speed up to, let's say, simulate quantum annealer or quantum Monte Carlo, which you can do with CMOS, which you can do with your laptop, okay? Is it better than that? Okay, does it scale better? They're real practical issues, okay?
So quantum Monte Carlo is solvable, you're saying? It's classically accessible for this problem?
Yeah, I'll explain that, yeah. Thank you. Okay, so what is the problem that it solves? And you basically have a quadratic cost function where x is 0 and 1, and you have some cost function, xi, xj, aij, plus some constants b times x. And what we want to do is find the value of x which minimizes the quadratic cost function. And the really interesting thing about the D-Wave approach is that if you can do this, then you can map a lot of real-world problems of minimizing cost functions, which are important to engineering science if you want to pick stocks that are better. Okay, you can put this picking a stock in terms of a cost function. So if you can solve this, you might be able to do really interesting things. Okay, now this problem's NP hard, and it means that other hard problems can be mapped to it, and this is why it's interesting to find. It's very hard to solve with regular computers, and it's very interesting to try to solve that.
Is there some mixing of NP-hard versus NP-complete in that statement?
I'm not an expert on this, so I don't want to, I
NP-hard, the Kubo problem, it's beyond NP.
But I'm asking about the mapping of all other problems into it.
Yeah, it can't mount all of it.
No, I don't think the statement's correct.
Okay. Anyway, this is the problem we're solving. And of course, you can map this to an Ising-Spinn glass, okay, using this kind of map thing. So, you know, and people have been looking at the Ising-Spinn glass for a long time. So it's interesting from the physics point of view, but solving this problem has potentially some, you know, engineering, commercial interest, okay? So thermal and quantum annealing, the simplest optimizer is to cool a system slowly at temperature, slowly cooling down the thermal fluctuations, and system overcomes various thermally to find the low energy state. Of course, in quantum annealing, you do the same kind of thing. You decrease the quantum fluctuations at low temperature, quantum mechanically tunnel through barriers, eventually to the low state. And this is the kind of the ideas behind this. And we're going to be looking at this thing, which is presumably quantum annealing. We're going to compare it with simulated classical and quantum annealing on a CPU, and you know, use this kind of with the same schedules. Okay, just to review, I think everyone here is probably an expert at this, but for a few people who may not be, in simulated annealing, what happens is in configuration space, you have a complicated energy space here, and you want to find some global minimum, and you get trapped in local minimum, and what you do is you initially start off at a high enough temperature so you have enough energy to go over these barriers. This kind of explores all this energy space, and then you slowly ramp down the temperature so that it will eventually find itself in the lowest energy state here.
That's the classical
simulated annealing. And at high temperature, it can jump over the barriers and then eventually settle to the local minimum. And of course, the problem is you might settle to a local minimum. That's not the global minimum by doing that. Okay, and of course, you repeat many times. Eventually, you'll find the global minimum. And this is actually a lot of effort has been put in this, obviously. And for Matthias, who's optimized this, he can have optimized codes that does 10 billion spin flips per second on his nice little Apple laptop. Okay, so it's very, you know, you can really map this onto a regular CPU and do that extremely efficiently. And that's a laptop, that's not even, you know, that's a relatively modest computer at this time. Okay, and then of course in quantum annealing, what you're going to do is essentially be able to tunnel through the barriers. And you do that by basically starting out with this A coefficient very high and the B coefficient low with this kind of a transverse field so that you're in a superposition of 0 and 1 of all the states. And then you turn this down and you turn up the H that you want to solve. And then the idea is you eventually fall into the minimum quantum tunneling through these configuration space to get to that. Now, simulated quantum annealing, computer quantum annealing, by Quantum Monte Carlo has been shown better than thermal annealing, at least for some problems. And one of the open questions here is for this particular problem they're going to be working on, is this better than thermal annealing? I mean, that's something they looked at in doing this. Now, this is, of course, related to adiabatic quantum computing, where you're doing the same thing, where you're starting in this state and you want to end up the state defined by this Hamiltonian, part of the Hamiltonian, ended up to the minimum state here, where you decrease this and increase this. Of course, Of course, to do this, to stay adiabatic, we need to move slow compared to the smallest gap scale, which can, because the gaps can be very, very small, get exponentially small, there that can be quite slow and not, and that's why it's an exponentially hard problem. Although the scaling here is expected to be exponential, there can still be some speed up compared to other methods. So it's still kind of interesting to look at. In the end is you have to compare that very carefully. So adiabatic quantum computing uses unitary evolution to stay in the ground state. Quantum annealing is similar to this, but it works at finite temperatures. It's coupled to a heat path. There is dissipation in the system, and it basically mixes the unitary evolution of here with thermalization and energy decay. So it's a little bit different process, but not to be, you know, exactly, it shouldn't be confused with that. So is the computation of power different? The short time coherent evolution with this tunneling provides speed up over a classical Monte Carlo quantum simulation. Okay, that's the open questions. Okay, so that's kind of a quick review. We now talk a little bit about the qubit devices, and it's made with superconducting Josephson junction flux qubits. And we have flux qubits here that are coupled together via lines and tunable couplers that can be changed in software. And here's your coupler here, and here's your qubits here. And you have a complicated system to couple these qubits, the flux qubits together. And then you can apply a magnetic field to the spins, and you can have Ising coupling spins. And then you can change this A and B coefficients by these global lines. And what's really amazing about this device is it's a very complex device with a lot of Josephson junctions there, which are essentially digital to analog converters to program in the strength of these coefficients for the Ising model. All the parameters are going to be a little bit different when you make this whole chip. Using these junction D to A converters, you can program in the device. So if, for example, the particular coefficients, they think they have about 4 bits of precision on them. So they can set the strength of the coupling to about 5% or so via these D to A converters, not shown here. But they can, you know, implement that coupling with fairly decent control with the relative coupling between them. What they have is unit cells of 4x4 qubits, where each qubit is connected to all the other qubits. And then these qubits, which is given here, let's not go into the detail. So each of these, each qubit, like qubit one here, is connected to all the other qubits in this array here. And then those 4x4 cells are then put in an array where each of the qubits here are also coupling down to a corresponding qubit in verticals, and then the horizontal qubits are connected to qubits. So it's not a full connectivity, okay? So you can see that this qubit here is locally connected to the 8 qubits here, but also connected to this qubit here, and this qubit here, and this qubit here, and these qubits, horizontal qubits, are connected. So it's not that every qubit is connected to every other qubit. It's a limited connectivity, but via other qubits, the whole array is connected together. Okay, and that's just for the realities of building this. Now, what this means with the limited connectivity, if you want to put an arbitrary problem in here, it takes some resources to scale an arbitrary problem onto this particular architecture. So if you have a problem of length L, size L, it takes L squared qubits to encode into this. Okay, so there's a big open question of, for real practical problems, how many qubits you need and the like, and how big of a system do you have to build. We're not going to talk about that in this talk, and we're going to just use the machine as it is to figure out how it works. I mean, yeah?
Just for curiosity, they have some gray color dots in the previous slide. Those are the qubits that not
these are the qubits that don't work. So there's some qubits around the edges that don't work, which is not unusual for a fab process, not to get everything. So they had 108 qubits that worked out at 128. It's fine. You can still do a lot of interesting things. Last thing, the role of coherence. What does the machine implement in the presence of decoherence? If you were have decoherence, very short time scale, less than about 0.1 nanoseconds, these are going to be classical states because the very large amount of decoherence, faster than the time scale of the couplings or the qubit energies, will mean you'll see classical states, no entanglement, and if you're going to do anything, you're just going to see you're going to see thermal annealing. In kind of this intermediate range, you are going to get some quantum effects because the decoherence is longer than the time scale of the couplings. You'll have delocalized energy eigenstates. You might have some kind of entanglement and some computational basis. However, there's going to be limited coherence between all these eigenstates. And of course, if the coherence is very big, you would get a perfectly coherent state, and you're going to see more of a different kind of quantum annealing where everything's kind of coherent over these scales. Just to say, where are you D-Wave believes they're in the 4 to 10 nanosecond range. It's very hard for me to understand their data, exactly why they claim that, but knowing their materials, knowing the way they design things, this is kind of a reasonable assumption that they're kind of in this range. So they have some amount of coherence. They're going to get some amount of tunneling, maybe a single qubit or maybe even two qubit quantum effects, but it's not going to be coherent across the whole array because this coherence time is kind of much shorter than the total time that you're going to do the whole annealing. So that's still something that needs to be understood, but you know, at least you expect to see some kind of quantum behavior. Okay, so that's kind of the basic background. The plan was to stop speculating about what's going on. You could argue forever about the role of coherence and entanglement, whatever. Okay, perform experiments that can tell what's going on. So it's nice to kind of frame this with three hypotheses. Is first of all, the machine is just a classical thermal annealer, and the effects are irrelevant. And then how you test that, you look at the performance of the system against a classical simulated annealer and see if the performance looks like that. Okay? Second is the machine is an incoherent quantum annealer. Quantum model is established for a short time, but quantum coherence is unimportant for the annealing process. You might want to test that to a simulated quantum annealer. Is a fully coherent quantum annealer with quantum speed up, provides strong advantages in tunneling through many variables in a large, many qubit parameter space. And would the scaling be better than you would get in the simulated quantum annealer? Okay, so that's kind of the hypothesis. You aren't sure how it would work, but you can do tests to kind of figure out which of these makes sense. And again, these three hypotheses correlate back to the fact of what we thought the coherence of the machine was. Yes?
What's the difference between a simulated quantum annealer and a coherent?
I would say this is, let's just talk about the data, okay? Let's just talk about the data. It's going to be very clear. Now, the strategy here is to give all the advantage to the DY1 by playing their game, okay? And use this chimera graph, this limited interconnectivity, as we talked about, instead of trying to embed a complex real application, okay? And then use the hardest problem with that, which is actually the couplings between the spins being plus or minus one couplings on all the allowed bonds that you have. And in fact, have zero, there was a term B times sigma, and have essentially a zero Z magnetic field. That just tends to align the spins with that field and make the problem easier. So we just have plus or minus one couplings on the J, okay, and only plus or minus one. So the tests are very simple, is you do a bunch of Monte Carlo simulations, both on the simulated thermal and quantum. This is with the computer and with the D-Wave 1. And basically we take a random set of these couplings, and so we take about 1,000 instances of these random couplings with different problem size, run about 1,000 repetitions of the simulations, and then maybe vary the parameters to find the optimal to the maximum number of solutions to find the ground state. Okay, and these are small enough systems at 100 qubits or so, you know where the ground state is. Okay, and evaluation, what is the total effort to reach the ground state with, say, some high probability, 90%, 99%, you can define what you want, say 99%. And then we're looking at these different quantiles, not just looking at the medium, not just, say, getting it right 50% of the time, then trying to understand that.
I'm not clear on the test, and it's a concern for me, and I've talked to D-Wave about this too, so it's not the first time I asked, but the test then is a computational test. You're saying to find the ground state, of a Hamiltonian that's deemed to be hard because of the plus-minus distribution amongst the J's.
Right.
But then the idea, you're saying, so it's going to be a fair test in that both the classical and the quantum computer are going to be optimized to find the ground state with 99%
right.
probability. Is that correct?
Yes. Or some probability, 90%, 99% right. So we're going to optimize the way that you do the annealing, and we're going to just see how much the total effort is.
Okay, last time I saw when D-Wave did it, their classical algorithm was based on a deterministic test. Like it felt like there was a comparison, it was an apples and oranges test.
Yeah, this is going to be as close to apples as it can be. And I'll explain that, And that's the idea, is the previous tests we kind of thought were not being fair, and this is a direct test between your computer resources and the D-Wave doing the same thing, okay? In fact, you plug in the same problems. Okay, so how does this kind of work? So we have these couplings, Jij, which are plus or minus one, and fields, external fields, Hi, we're going to take Hi equal to zero because that's an easier problem. So you set Jij equal to plus or minus one randomly. So for that random set of Jij's, we then, for that particular instance, we perform 1,000 more annealing runs, and we measure the final state, the final energy, and we just count the number of times S out of that 1,000 that we found the ground state, which we can do. These are small enough problems, we can know that. And then you calculate the success rate of finding that ground state. And then you take that success rate for each instance, you do many instances, and then you plot the success rate as a histogram. Okay? So here's the probability. Probability S equal 1 are easy cases. Particularly, they're random cases, but they're particularly easy. And S equal probability, S equals 0 are hard cases, okay? So when you put in random couplings in the way that it's all interconnected, and you do simulated thermal annealing, you find a distribution that is unimodal, going off small number easy, small number hard. When you solve it with the computer, thermal annealing. Okay? Is that clear what we're doing here? Everyone okay? Okay, so that's the basic idea. So here's the classical annealer, simulated thermal annealing. Oops. Simulator quantum annealing, quantum Monte Carlo. Basic, same idea. Now, you find a very different histogram. Okay, now instead of seeing unimodal, it's bimodal. Some of them are easy, some of them are hard, with this dip in the center. Okay?
What if classical failed for easy?
Excuse me?
Classical is failing for the easy.
What I would say is it's just that when you put this random instances, some of the particular examples of the coupling are an easy solution and some of them are a hard solution because you're just taking random JIJs. And for this algorithm, it gives you probability distribution like that to solve that problem. Here, it's different, okay? And I'll talk about why this is bimodal, okay? So you just put in the same thing, you do the same thing with D-Wave 1. What is the probability histogram? And it's this, okay? Which looks like the simulated quantum annealer, not as the simulated thermal annealer.
This is the experiment.
Excuse me?
This is the experiment.
This is the D-Wave 1. You put in, you program in random JIJs for 10,000, 1,000 instances. You then run this a bunch of times. This is for the experiment. So these are the computer experiments, and then this is for the hardware D-Wave 1.
In those simulations, your transverse field, H, is always zero.
We've set it equal to zero because that's a harder problem. If you make H finite, then you have a preferred orientation to the spins, and the problems become easier. Okay, so we just set H equal to zero. It's a harder problem. We're trying to do the hardest problem we can. Okay, so there's the D wave one. And what you see is the bimodal histogram successor due is semi-quadrimolar. We tentatively conclude the D wave one is not a thermal annealer, kind of what we expected. We thought there were some quantum mechanics going on, and it's consistent in behavior with the simulated quantum annealing of quantum Monte Carlo. Okay, so that's a tentative just by looking at this. There's more tests you can do, I can talk about, but that's the first thing you do.
Does this already mean that if you were working in a regime where there was no quantum coherence at all, this result would be impossible?
That's right. I think you would get a result like this. That's right. So right away when you see this, you strongly suspect that there's some quantum mechanics going on. How much is an open question, okay, which we can try to address. But just from this data itself, you say, oh, there is some quantum mechanics. This is not unexpected. Like I say, we know about flux qubits, we know there's quantum mechanics going on, we think that the coherence time, a few nanoseconds, is longer than the kind of the coupling time scale, so this is not unexpected. The question is how good is it is another thing, which I'm going to talk about. Okay, now, you see that some of these, the probability is zero, and these are the hard instances. And these are easy instances. It kind of breaks up into hard and easy. So you want to understand what's going on with hard and easy. So what you do is you do very complex, these are very time-consuming calculations, but you take an easy instance and you take a hard instance, and then as you change your annealing schedule, goes from this gamma factor going starting at 3 and then annealing down at 0. So this is all transverse Hamiltonian, and then this is the full Hamiltonian. And then you look at the energy spectrum of the exact solution. You diagonalize the problem, just very time consuming. And then you say, what is the energy gap between the ground state and the next excited state? Now, when gamma is big here, this is where you have the transverse field. So this part of the curve doesn't really matter. What happens here is what happens as gamma goes to zero and at your end of the schedule. And what you see for the easy instances is the gap, there's always this finite gap, and then it just essentially goes to zero because there's some degeneracy of the states there. But what you see in the hard instances is that this gap goes down to zero right here, which you're saying that there are multiple low energy states that you can get stuck into. So the way I like to explain it is that the easy instances, those particular choices of JIJs, your energy landscape tends to look like a funnel, okay? So that as you put in somewhere in this energy landscape, and it's just going to fall to the lowest energy state of the funnel, and you're going to get the right answer, okay? That's a particular choice here. In the hard instances, you have an energy landscape that more looks like an egg carton, where there's lots of local minimum. And then you can get stuck with these small gaps because of that A carton shape. You're gonna get stuck in those other states and you're gonna get the wrong answer. And it's just, you know, the random numbers you chose, sometimes it's easy, sometimes it's hard. And the correlation of easy and hard here, here and here, this correlates with the gap structure for the few number of instances they did. So that makes sense. So why are some easy, why are some hard? Okay, so multiple ground states become degenerate. That's determines whether it's easy or hard. Small gaps for hard instances. So let's do this. Let's take a particular choice of JIJ and run the simulated quantum annealer on a computer and run it on D-Wave 1. And then you say, well, what's the probability that you got the correct ground state, okay? So these are, for a particular case of JIJ, random instances of JIJ, simulate quantum annealing, D-wave 1, and we see where the hard instance is for D-wave 1, mostly correlates with the hard instances for simulated quantum annealing. And the easy instances for simulated quantum annealing correlate with the easy instances of D-wave 1. Right? What's easy and what's hard for both of these methods are correlated. Not perfectly, but fairly well correlated. And that, to me, seems to be a much more stronger evidence that these two are kind of doing the same thing. Okay, maybe not exactly the same, but, you know, pretty strong correlation. Now, when you look at this, about 95% or so, or maybe a little bit larger, are correlated. There are some outliers here and here. Okay, and next one I want to talk about is those outliers are due to the calibration problems. When you have a computer, you know exactly what your coupling is. When you use the D-Wave 1, things can be have difficulty getting it calibrated properly because it's a real physical system with analog control. The way to kind of get around this problem and see what's going on is to realize that you can have a gauge transformation of the system to encode it in the same problem in a different way, kind of average over all these calibration problems, and then get a better result. And the basic idea is if you have a Hamiltonian here with some JIJs, and let's forget about H for a second, and what you can do is, this is going to find some particular minimization set with particular set 0 and 1s. If you flip for each of the sigma j's, you flip the JIJ from plus 1 to minus 1 with this gauge transformation, then you should basically, you're encoding the same problem with just a different set of output 0 and 1s, but the effective Hamiltonian is the same. Okay? So you can take a particular problem, do random gauge transformations here, and then see if you get the same result. Okay, and you can also, what it allows you to do is with these different gauge transformations, if you have calibration problems on a few qubits, you can then deal with it. So you're also having to do some gauge average to find this. Okay, so if you do a D-Wave 1 with hard and easy problems, and you just do a gauge transformation, you see that with the gauge transformation, there are some easy and hards for both gauge transformation, and some hard and hard for both gauge transformation. But there's a significant amount of others that's easy for one and hard for the other, which says that it's just the calibration problem. Because you know the fundamental symmetry of the Hamiltonian, these should be correlated. Okay, so you know that that's a problem. One of the interesting things, if you take the D-Wave 1 and you do it repeated after a month apart, there's actually excellent correlation here, which means that the calibration stays stable over time, but there are a few problems out here, okay? But it does kind of show that it correlates with itself over time. It's a stable calibration. If you take a simulated quantum annealing and then do this gauge transformation, you basically see super good correlation, as you expect, because there's no numerical errors for setting up your Hamiltonian. So, you know, gauge transformation here makes a lot of sense. Okay, so what we're going to do is run repetitions of a particular JIJ set with different gauge choices, and then average the success probabilities over the gauge choices to kind of remove what might be calibration errors into the problem. Okay, and when you do that, you get better, much better correlations with the gauge averaging. So here's simulate quantum annealing. We don't have to gauge average that because there are no calibration problems. We do the gauge average here, and now we see a tight clustering here and here. As you expect, we really remove all these outliers. And then you expect some kind of intermediate range here, but much better correlations. And actually fairly good correlation between the years. So the conclusion we get from all this is within the calibration uncertainties that are already there, the machine works like a quantum annealer. Very, very similar to a quantum annealer. And then the easy and hard cases are very well correlated.
You also just chosen the best gauge instead of averaging?
One could do that, but it's very hard to know what the best gauge is because it's hard to measure what your calibration errors are. And in fact, it's very hard to calibrate the machine. You know, you set up a machine, and then they do lots and lots of proprietary calibration programs to figure that out. So the idea here is you just try random gauge changes as part of your trying different runs, and then see out of all that whether you'll find the minimum. It's a, you know, initial strategy. But that really seems to help, and to get, you know, kind of average out those problems. Okay. And in fact, if you look at the correlation between simulated quantum annealing and D-wave 1, and you look at the correlation between D-wave 1 and the gauge average D-wave 1, you see this is much better correlated with the machine by itself. Okay, so it's really is kind of an interesting way to average over those problems. Okay. Now we want to start talking about optimizing the total effort and scaling. Okay, we know that it works like simulated quantum annealer. So what is the scaling? What happens as we have more and more qubits? And first thing you have to do is talk about optimizing the particular annealing schedule that you want to do. And here we're going to be talking about the total effort, which is for a particular simulation, which is the effort of the simulation is the number of repetitions needed to get the ground state with, say, 99% probability, although we all look at various quantiles here. So let's take an example of a classical annealer for 108 spins. And when you do the classical annealing, there's a variable in here as how many updates per spin, which is called sweeps. Okay, so you have to change the states in some thermal random way to be able to find it. And the more times you change that, the more effort you have because you're changing the variables more often. So if you look at the total effort required to get to various quantiles, let's just look at the 99% here, versus the number of updates per spin, you see that the lowest effort is about at 50 or so updates per spin. And then as you start updating the spin more and more often, okay, you can still get to 99%, but it takes more computational effort. So you have to adjust some of the internal parameters of these optimizers to make it make it efficient. And for simulated thermal annealing, it's this parameter 50-50 states. Now to get this, you need about 500,000 spin flips, and this is about 250 microseconds. When you work through the math on a CPA core, that's 250 microseconds on one CPU core. His has multiple cores. This is about 50 microseconds to do this kind of thing. And then as you go to less quantiles from 99 to say 50%, you need about a factor of 10 less computational resources, okay? So then what you do is say, okay, let's test the simulator annealers against D-wave 1. And this is going to be a simulated and thermal annealing for the various quantiles versus the problem size between whether 30 or so to about 100 with various quantiles. And you see, as you make the problem size bigger, the total effort, the number of spin flips, increases exponentially. So that at 99% here and 100 qubits, that's 10 to the 6, 10 to the 7 spin flips. Say that's about here, that number is about a millisecond on a CPU, roughly. Okay? D-wave 1, this is scaling with gauge average. We're actually not taking into account the programming time and other things. We're just taking account into the annealing time. Withia is just giving D-Wave all the advantage it can. with the idea that eventually they'll figure out how to make that faster and get it to work. And if you're working at harder and harder problems, this is going to be less and less of an issue. Okay? So what they see for the 50% quantile here is that the total time for the machine to get this right stays relatively constant. Okay, at, you know, 10, 20 microseconds. Okay? But remember, there were easy and hard problems. So let's go to the 99% quantile. And in that case, the total effort actually goes up kind of rapidly here. Okay? So if you want to compare this to this, again, ignoring anything other than the annealing time at kind of 95% quantile here at 100, think that's about a millisecond of computational time in annealing schedule, and, you know, somewhat comparable to this. Okay? Now, that's, I would say that's kind of amazing that with some, you know, new machine that's not CMOS, you have comparable performance, okay, for these problems. A millisecond here, maybe a little bit less than a millisecond here. So that's actually pretty impressive performance that you can get this kind of comparison here. But do note that this here costs a few thousand dollars, and this here costs $10 million. Okay, so for 10,000 times more expensive, you've gotten the same performance. Okay? And then, of course, here, if you want to put more resources in, you go to NVIDIA, you get GPU cards, you scale up, CMOS is really cheap, and you can, you know, scale the performance of this. And that's just, you know, buying a card at your local game store. And this, okay, this requires a lot of work, but it still is impressive. Now, the problem is, the issue is how is this scale is going to scale in the future? Okay? This has a little certain slope here. Is the slope here really going to how it scale, or is it going to scale like this? And that's somewhat of an open question, okay? This is scaling, and that's something that needs to be thought about, okay? And let me tell you why I personally think I'm a little bit concerned about the scaling of D-Wave 1. And whether this is going to be scaling more favorably, flatter than this, or less favorably, steeper than this. And one of the issues that are really important has to do, going back to this question of easy and hard problems. Okay? If you take different system sizes, you see here at n equal 58 qubits, basically, none are at zero probability, so none are hard, and they're all easy. And then in 84 and 128, you start seeing hard problems. And remember, these hard problems, where did they come from? The fact that they were not funnel-shaped, which is, of course, easy for anything. They were starting to get kind of egg carton-shaped, and you get stuck in them. What happens as you go to 128? This goes down, this starts going up. At 200, this is going down, this is going up more. 288, 392, 512. Once you go to 512, essentially all of your problems are hard. They are not easy anymore. Okay? And what I find kind of amazing is even at 128, for these random couplings, a good fraction of your solutions are trivially easy. They're funnel-shaped energy things. But once you go up to 512, then they start becoming hard. And it's kind of surprising. 128 sounds like a lot of qubits. However, given their interconnectivity or whatever, it's not a hard problem yet. It's only when you get past 200 up to 500 are you looking at truly hard problems with this thing, where you have lots of energy minimum that makes the problem hard. So it's going to be very interesting when you go from 128 to 512 to see kind of how the problems scale. Okay? So To go back into the scaling, just look at simulated thermal annealing, simulated quantum annealing. These are both computer experiments. Basically, you see as you go to bigger and bigger qubits, these scale exponentially harder, as you expect. Note that the slope of this is similar to the slope of this. However, note that these simulator quantum annealers take more time, so that, let's say, a millisecond was here and a millisecond here. So actually, the simulated quantum annealers just shown computationally shows no advantage. That was kind of surprising to Matthias. And then, of course, we want to know, you know, how does the real quantum annealer scale? If it scales like this, which is no better than this, you would not expect a D-wave to be any better than doing CMOS, because CMOS is so much cheaper. It's not going to scale with size. If the D-wave scales less steeply than this, then there might be some advantages.
Is this known, the simulating quantum annealing on a laptop, or is the algorithm that's being used to do that known to have a certain scaling and be the best?
Yeah. Yeah, that's actually a question for Matthias.
Okay.
And what happens is whether it's better or not depends a lot on the problem.
Yeah.
And I believe he's using fairly efficient code because this is what he does for a living. Okay, so that's fairly efficient. But then I think some problems are easy and some are hard. And I think it turns out that for this particular problem, the way that it's interconnected, they have similar scalings from one to the other, but that this is less efficient.
There's a property of tunneling that if the wells are of equal depth,
right,
tunneling works very well. If the wells are not of equal depth, then tunneling is can be actually non-existent.
Right.
And so I can imagine that for certain problems where you have an egg carton type,
right,
of shape, that you have wells of equal depth, and then the quantum might present an efficiency. Whereas if you have unequal depths,
yeah. But then of course you have to throw in the fact that there's noise and there's dissipation, and then you know all these ideas become hard to understand. So yes, and you know all these could play into it. Okay, so you know. A surprising result, the simulated quantum annealer shows no advantage. However, how does the D-wave quantum annealer scale? Is there a quantum speed up? We really need to go to larger machines where the problems get hard to tell for sure. Okay, so for example, one of the interesting things is they looked at the problem size and the failure rates. And this is with the 100 qubit machine. And they, as it got up to 100, the failure rate started to go up to, you know, something they're worrying about. With the new machine, 512 qubits, the whole calibration is working better. They've improved the machine. And now they start getting similar failures at a much larger number of qubits. So they are improving the machine. It is getting better. And, you know, they're working right now on getting this data and carefully comparing the scaling between the different ISMC. So this is work in progress, and we won't know until, you know, we get the machine installed, a USC 512 qubit machine, get it installed, start testing these algorithms. Hopefully in the next new months, they'll be able to look at the scaling carefully and figure that out. Okay? So kind of to conclude, this black box D-Wave machine, it really works like a quantum annealer, and it found ground states of 100 qubits, and you know, even with the 500 machine, they have some first data that shows they can find ground states of a 500 spin glass. This is impressive. There's a lot of states, 2 to the 500 states there. They're finding that. It correlates very well with the similar quantum annealer, at least tested up to 108 spins, and that'll be tested more. So it's quite interesting, okay? However, there are easy and hard instances, and the hard instances are hard due to voidal level crossings. And when you get greater than 200 spins, more, you'll have more and more avoided level crossings, they'll be more complex. How is it going to be happen there? Let me note that this scaling, the computational resources you need, is expected to be exponential for both the D-Wave machine and the computer algorithms, both thermal and classical. The question is, for the D-Wave machine, will the parameters be such that it's a smaller exponential and thus better? And even if it's just exponential, but just better because it's smaller parameters, it could be a really interesting tool to use for real problems. And that's something they're trying to figure out and work on. And if it is, then it's a useful machine. Of course, these simulated computer routines are much faster than exact solvers. Thermal is faster than simulated quantum annealer. And I would say the fastest thermal annealer is roughly, on a single CPU, is roughly that given by the D-Wave machine, which is nice. But of course, like I said, the D-Wave machine is more expensive. And then with the exponential scaling is better, that's the whole question. Is the scaling going to be better? And you know, they're looking forward to looking at the new D-Wave machine at 512 qubits, and hopefully they can start answering that question. Okay, so that's it. Thank you very much.
Their estimate is that it's in between completely incoherent and completely coherent.
Right.
First of all, they're working on trying to make it more coherent. And second of all, can you comment on how much you think that would improve the speed?
Yeah, okay. They are not really working on making it more coherent. So they very much believe that coherence is not a big issue. And they're more working on scaling up. And given what we see here, I actually think that's the right strategy. Now, to make it more coherent, we know a lot about materials. In fact, that's one of our specialties here at UC Santa Barbara. Yeah, you can make it out of better materials, but it's not just the materials. It's the way that all the qubits are put together. And it's kind of designed like a regular classical digital integrated circuit. Or, you know, it's very much that way. So to have better coherence, you just have to completely redesign everything, and then it's not clear how it works. So I don't think, maybe they can get a factor of two or three better coherence, but it's going to be very hard to get super long coherence. And what it seems that the D-Wave is just learning how to make more and more qubits, and since it's a lot of qubits with many, you know, 100,000 Josen junctions, that's a very hard fabrication process, and they're just focusing on how to do that properly. Fortunately, you know, there's a lot of foundries out there, and the materials to make all these Josephson qubits are not that crazy for all the foundries. So they're really piggybacking off of what's known in semiconductor processing to build this up. And it's actually been a very clever approach of them, is to kind of use conventional fabrication to figure it out. One of the big bummers for us, the field, is that the foundry they were using to make the 512 chip is closing down. So they have to find a new foundry and then transfer all that technology to get to the next generation. But, you know, it's just money. You just put money, you feed the big check into these installations, and out come your wafers, you know, after enough time figuring it out.
Just theoretically speaking, since it's already behaving as a quantum annealer, would there be anything to be gained hypothetically if you could go to higher coherence?
See, the way I kind of look at it, and I think it would be nice for people to think about this more carefully, is the amount of coherence you have may allow, you know, one spin the tunnel, or maybe two spin the tunnels. But you're probably not going to tunnel a configuration of 5 or 10 spins, because you just, the gap's too small and the decoherence is going to mess you up. So I think that's, in my view, that's kind of the way to think about it. And then the question is with a little bit of minimal amount of tunneling like that, with some thermal annealing, is that going to help you on really big problems? Okay, that's, you know, that's an open question that it would be nice. And, you know, hopefully people seeing this, they might figure out some more clever ways to test the machine with these kind of experiments in mind. I mean, you can set up a Hamiltonian where you have a degenerate states and you can check for the physics of all this. And I think those kind of scientific experiments would be super useful. I mean, D-Wave, they're just trying to, you know, solve some practical engineering or financial problems so that, you know, people will buy their company and put more money into it. But the science community, I think, is an opportunity just using the machine. You should be able to figure out some of the dynamics. And D-Wave is doing a little bit of that. But I think scientists could really help out here.
I think I also missed something. Can you say more about what you mean that it's faster than the fastest? What do you mean by the speed here?
What I would say is the D-Wave machine at even 100 qubits is comparable to a single core CPU.
You mean actually in the time it takes to run?
Yeah, just the annealing time in a D-Wave is very similar to the run time of a CPU.
Run time of a single instance or the time to find the...
Well, let's say many instances to find 99% probability.
Right.
And that's impressive, to make a, you know, a machine that is comparable to the performance of a core CPU. Of course, it's $10 million instead of $1 million, instead of $1,000. But it's actually, I say, it's pretty impressive that, you know, they can do that.
So when you say it's 1,000 times faster than your...
Yeah, this is confusing. The thermal simulated thermal anneal is faster than quantum anneal.
But that statement implies that the D-Wave machine is sound.
No, this is confusing statement.
Oh, okay.
So the D-Wave and the simulated thermal annealers are about the same, but the simulated quantum is slower by about 1,000 times. So you could say that the D-Wave, if you're comparing the D-Wave with the computer quantum annealer, the D-Wave's faster. So, you know, that's one way to say it. And then, of course, the question is, how is it going to scale?
Your computer, of course, is using a classical...
Excuse me?
Your computer, of course, is using a classical...
Yeah. 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 Yes, of course. Of course.
That makes sense.
Yeah, so...
I'm trying to get just a... single statement here out of this. It's fantastic. I mean, I like that. It is the first time, I mean, thank you very much for doing this.
Yeah,
it is the first time that, you know, I can follow something in scientific terms and not in bloggish terms.
Yeah, so exactly.
Beautiful.
Yeah, that was the point.
This is an important contribution to science. Yeah?
Yeah.
But, I mean, to distill a single answer. So if someone asks me, is this machine better than a classical computer? It seems to me that the answer at the moment is, I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah, and maybe we will see with the next generation. Is that a fair
statement? Yes, I would say that they're comparable. Ignore the price. They're comparable at this point.
Yes.
And then the whole question is, how does it scale?
Okay.
And then that's something that has to be figured out in the next machine or the next machine. That's for the future.
Yes.
So in that sense, it's very interesting. But again, the caveat here is, when I look at like the instance, the easy and hard instances, I'm personally concerned that they're scaling off of easy instances. And as you start having more and more hard instances and a higher dimensional tunneling that you need, it's not quite clear, you know, how it's going to scale. But you just have to test it. Yes. Yeah.
So you said the coherence is not really important for them, right? So they just scaling, but coherence is not important. But the question is, so what is going to be quantum about this quantum?
What I would say is they are seeing quantum tunneling of maybe one or two spin, maybe three spin configurations. They are seeing some quantum tunneling. But my guess is that a 10 spin tunneling event or something, they're not going to see that. That's my guess. So there is a little bit of tunneling going on here, you know, short tunneling. So you're going to tunnel from one local minimum to the other with one or two qubits changing. But you're not going to tunnel over 10 qubits changing. That's my guess. Because you don't have the coherence for that.
So what about scalability then in terms of what they...
Exactly. That's the thing. As you go to bigger and bigger sizes, and you need more and more tunneling to find the global minimum, My guess is that the quantum nature of the D-Wave computer will probably fail. But, you know, there's thermal things, there's all these things going on. I don't know. But it would be, that'd be a very interesting question to understand. Now that we have some idea of what this thing is doing, maybe people can do some really good theory on it. And you can go in, and if you want to test multidimensional tunneling, you should be able to go in, design a Hamiltonian, and actually measure, you know, what those rates should be. I think that should be possible. But it requires designing a good scientific experiment.
So it seems to me there are two issues. One is the issue, is quantum coherence playing a role or not? But then there's another point you made, which is that this is an analog computer.
Right.
And so regardless of whether it's quantum or classical, it's hard to see how an analog computer scales and doesn't ultimately disappear.
Right. In the end, you have to encode some real world problem into this computer. So there's first the fact that the limited connectivity gives you scaling problem, and then the fact that you can't control things properly.
Do they have an idea? I mean, is this averaging over gauge going to give you a way?
Yeah, this is all unknown. But believe me, this is what D-Wave is spending all their time on.
I imagine that's a huge problem.
That's a huge problem, and they're trying to show that they can encode real world problems and in some appropriate way and get answers out of that. So that's what they're focusing on, which is, you know, I understand that. It's important, and that's a hard problem too. But I would say that scientifically, we have other problems that we can address, which, you know, maybe people would enjoy thinking about. Yeah?
In your opinion, is it like even feasible to have 100 qubits and cool down the fridge and wire them up, all these things that you didn't talk, is that like even feasible?
Well, they've done 500, and when I look at the technology, this is possible because they're using single flux quantum logic to build a control system that controls their qubits. And since they are not worried about coherence, you can then optimize for this digital and analog control and then do that. It's very impressive. This is probably the most complex Josephson circuit that's been made. But, you know, they've done it, and it works fairly well. It's really impressive. Now, for me, what I like about this is we're thinking about, you know, doing some kind of control on qubits with long coherence. The fact that they've been able to integrate the control on their chip in some way, I actually think bodes well for the rest of the community who are trying to do this with coherence. It's some kind of rough existence proof. But what they've done is very impressive in terms of that hardware. But it's really just standard Josephson classical digital logic, and they've just done that extremely well. And that's the most of their, you know, hardware design is getting that right. And it's very impressive. Yeah?
Can you just kind of give my opinion in terms of the stuff, in terms of, can I conclude that it's just building better analog computer?
Yes. It's a very good analog, but it's an analog computer that uses some amount of quantum mechanics in it.
There's some quantum coherence here.
There is some quantum coherence, and it looks like they're using it to their advantage, which is pretty neat. So it's a very nice, very nice thing. But, you know, the real question is, what is it going to, how's it going to scale long term? Is it going to be useful? And that, you know, that goes to the core of their basic strategy of whether coherence matters that much for what they're doing.
And this is a great approach to addressing this question.
Okay.
Because if I now wanted to start a company that would build something, I'd like to understand what physics is in there so I could build a better one. So my question is this. Coherence is not a uniquely quantum phenomenon. It occurs classically in fields of force. So can I map this into, say, an optical waveguide array with both linear and non-linear, which would have some element of coherence in, some element of tunneling, a lot of the same sorts of features? It would be, in that sense, entirely classical physics, but nonetheless may have some of the same interference problems.
Yeah, it would be very interesting.
Is it known?
I don't know the field well enough to see that. I have heard that there's one effort somewhere to build a classical thermal annealer to solve these problems by just using conventional room temperature electronics. To do that, with maybe there would be some advantage in scaling to doing that. That's kind of an interesting approach. And you see here that the thermal annealer has some advantages over quantum annealers. So there might be some classical approaches going down this direction that would be interesting. But in the end, the problem is it's very hard to set the parameters accurately in an analog world.
But this is also got tensor products. I mean, you would need 2 to the 108 different orthogonal modes of your interferometer.
That's right.
And this, it lives in a Hilbert space with that dimension.
Or some reduced dimension. It's certainly a big dimension because the full coherence isn't there.
It is.
Yeah, that's right.
2 to the n orthogonal states is what this is looking at. So it's the fact that you're encoding orthogonal states in the tensor product structure rather than the unary structure.
But we do have, you know, a single thermal interferometer. We can build those now. It's not inconceivable that you could do something like this with a mixture of quantum coherence and plasma coherence.
I see. So you put single photon states.
States into big complex integrated interferometers.
It's not clicking into single photon states.
Or something, but you need orthogonal states somehow.
Yeah.
But it's still somewhat. It's a classical interferometer, but you better have non-classical light in it.
I think you need something like a Hund-Mantel effect in there somewhere.
Well, I'm wondering if you can do it with some weak, not with a nonlinear.
Oh, that's the other way.
Sure. Yeah.
Because then you need some classical light in it.
Yep.
They are using the quantum. They're definitely the quantum mechanics is getting used in their device. How much will it that help in scaling is very much an open question. So it's going to be interesting in the next few years as we get to get our hands on these machines and be able to test all this. Yes.
When you have a successful annealer, you find the ground state. Do you know by kind of a variational principle that you're there?
So I'm not an expert on this. It turns out for problems, I believe below about 200 qubits or so, there are ways to know what the exact ground states are. And then once you get up to I, those become very inefficient. But there are ways to kind of know how close you are. And I think there are techniques to kind of understand that.
The reason that I ask is it really necessary to calibrate it so that it becomes kind of gauge invariant? Because you just take the lowest solution that you get from anywhere.
Right, and that's useful, absolutely. And that's one of the things that D-Wave will say is, okay, it may not scale perfectly, but it's fine. But that's why you have to do very careful tests to understand really what's going on. And at some thing, if you lose your quantum tunneling and it's not annealing in that quantum way because you're starting to have to tunnel large configuration spaces, then these ideas will break down. So this requires a lot of work to understand that. I would say, yeah, but in terms of that line of thinking, I think the real issue is the encoding of a real problem and can you do that efficiently? You know, yeah, you don't need to find the optimal state. A good state is fine. That's, you know, it's interesting. Okay, well, thank you very much.